Hi, I'm Patricia Carvelis, the host of Politics Now, the ABC's podcast unpacking the latest political news when it happens. Every weekday, you'll hear me and the sharpest political minds at the ABC.
Me, Jacob Greber.
Me, Raph Epstein.
Me, Claudia Long.
Me, David Spears.
And me, Melissa Clark, in the chair for Fran Kelly for the Party Room every Thursday.
So join me for Politics Now, download and follow on the ABC Listen app.
From Wondery Country, I'm Luke Sidham Dunton, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, why has the Bureau of Meteorology's new website cost almost $100 million? The figure is more than two dozen times what was previously claimed. So today, we'll put that question to the Bureau's new boss.
On taking the helm of the Bureau, I wanted to make that as transparent as possible and be open and honest with the Australian people.
Then,
I don't remember the last time someone in a burqa robbed a bank.
Politicians from all sides are putting Pauline Hanson on blast after her latest stunt in the Senate.
The only thing that you can be guaranteed of is that some girl in a headscarf on her way to school today is going to be bullied on the train.
And we'll end with a little bit of Hollywood. Actor Russell Crowe discusses his latest film, which turns back the pages of history, looking at the post-war period and the Nuremberg trials.
We've had two world wars. How do we ensure this doesn't happen again? Make sure that the men in positions of power know that they will be held responsible for their actions.
From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. Well, the week of wild weather has really continued. Severe storms delivering giant hail, record amounts of lightning in South Australia, and then there's Tropical Cyclone Fina, which has moved on to Western Australia, weakening as it passes the coast for a second time. In the meantime, though, the Bureau of Meteorology is weathering a separate storm over its controversial website design. The agency has revealed the cost to be $96.5 million. The BOM had initially said the redesign would cost $4 million. So what's happened? Well, you've heard us discuss this story for the last few days. So today we got the chance to put questions to the Bureau itself. Dr. Stuart Minchin is the new Chief Executive Officer of the Bureau of Meteorology, and he came on with Sally Sarah this morning.
This discrepancy between $4 million and more than 96, how's this happened?
Look, it's really been a communication misunderstanding around that. Originally, the Bureau was asked what the design costs for the website front end were, which was the $4 million figure. But the website front end, if you like, is just the tip of the iceberg. Underlying that is a huge system that takes tens of thousands of instruments across the Australian region, satellite imagery, brings that into a supercomputer where the modelling is done out to production systems in order to make the forecast. And the entire system had to be replaced after a hacking incident in 2015. So, yeah, the total cost of the website includes all of that back end, not just the front end.
When did you become aware of the true total figure of $96.5 million?
Well, look, I've only been in the Bureau for 2 weeks, as soon as I started looking into this issue. It's been quite open within the Bureau, the cost of this this website. This is part of a larger program.
So if it's been open within the Bureau, why wasn't it communicated more widely? I mean, we can talk about front end and so on, but common sense would say, how much is this whole redesign, rebooting of the website cost? It's 96.5.
Yeah, look, absolutely. I think there was perhaps a communication error made at the time where the exact question that was asked by the journalist at the time, which was about the website design costs, was answered rather than a more holistic answer. I can commit that on taking the helm of the Bureau, I wanted to make that as transparent as possible and be open and honest with the Australian people.
Was the minister informed of the 96.5 figure or the full figure at an earlier time, or was that only in the past week when it came out in the media?
Well, look, As I mentioned, this is part of a larger program of work that was actually signed off by Cabinet back in 2017 and has repeatedly been part of the budget updates. So the website component is about 10% of a much larger program of replacing all of the Bureau's back-end systems and processes. And that's been visible to government all the way through.
Stuart Minchin, let me read you a bit, some comments from Brad Perry. He's the Chief Executive of Grain Producers SA. He's based on Eyre Peninsula in South Australia. He's saying with that kind of expenditure, something like Doppler radar on Eyre Peninsula, where there's a black hole for that kind of technology, would have been much better spent. Do you agree the money could have been better spent?
Well, look, I think we've got to look back at the hacking incident in 2015, which really opened up the threat that that hackers could take down the entire Bureau system. Imagine if we were facing a situation like Tropical Cyclone Fina and we were unable to issue a weather forecast for a week or 2 weeks period because hackers had got into our network. So this was a really urgent need to address what was a very insecure...
It's urgent, but it's taken 10 years to fix it by the sounds of that timeline.
And it's a massive project. Look, please don't be... don't misunderstand the size of this. We had to install a backup supercomputer. This is a massive investment and a huge amount of technical work.
So for the past 10 years, has the weather forecasting capabilities, has that been vulnerable until this has all been put together?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it's been, progressively, this has been protected and improved, and it's really only with the latest update of the website that the front end, the web access, has actually been updated to more secure and more secure platform.
For the safety of communities and for multi-million dollar industries, like the comments that we've seen in the Adelaide Advertiser this morning from Brad Perry, are investments like Doppler in Doppler black holes, are they something the Bureau will look at?
Look, we absolutely understand that there are some communities in Australia that are still not covered by radar and would like to have radar coverage. Unfortunately, we're only funded to support the existing radar network at the moment. It's certainly, if the opportunity arises and we are funded to provide extra radars, we will do so. But at the moment, we're only able to support those radars that are already installed we don't have the resources to maintain any more than that at this point in time. We are covering more than 95% of the Australian population with radar, but the Eyre Peninsula, Margaret River are places that arguably next on the list if we're able to be resourced to do so.
Dr. Stuart mentioned there, the new Chief Executive of the Bureau of Meteorology. He was speaking to Sally Sara on Radio National Breakfast. Well, let's turn to some federal politics because One Nation leader Pauline Hanson has been suspended from the Senate after once again wearing a burqa in Parliament. Now, we raised the stunt in two interviews today. There were strong comments from both Labor Minister Tanya Plibersek and the former Coalition Minister George Brandis. Our political correspondent Melissa Clark can fill you in on what they said and just what Pauline Hanson did in the Senate.
Well, what we saw was Senator Hanson enter the chamber wearing a burqa. She was wanting to initiate a debate on banning face coverings, a burqa or a niqab, in public spaces. This is very reminiscent of what we saw in 2017, where she effectively did the same thing. What it immediately led to was the government moving to have her censured and then suspended from the parliament, which is ultimately what happened. She then refused to leave the chamber, which meant the whole operations of the chamber were shut down for about an hour and a half, almost 2 hours. So it ended up being quite a disruptive process to the Senate's operations for the day. But we saw Penny Wong, being the government leader in the Senate, really take the lead in trying to quickly nip the process in the bud by moving quickly to suspend Senator Hanson. She drew on the circumstances of the last time Senator Hanson tried to do this when she was condemned by George Brandis, who was then sitting in the role that Penny Wong sits in now, and really echoed some of his comments, drawing on them directly to condemn the senator, and then, you know, added her own assessment of what she thought of this move by Senator Hanson.
Whatever our own beliefs may be, the sort of disrespect that you are engaging in now is not worthy of a member of the Australian Senate, and it should not be allowed to stand.
She is still facing criticism from everyone, from Senator Fatima Payman, who, of course, herself wears a hijab, in the chamber, saying that senators' actions were abhorrent and disrespectful. We've had Susan Lee, the Leader of the Opposition, put out a statement condemning it, describing it as a reheating, a desperate stunt. We had Tanya Plibersek on the program earlier this morning, and she was dismissive not only of the actions, but also of the suggestion behind Pauline Hanson's move, which was to try and get the burqa banned. It was saying it was a security risk. Tanya Plibersek rejected that.
I don't remember the last time someone in a burqa robbed a bank. I think it's completely standard, rehashed Pauline Hanson headline-grabbing behaviour. The only thing that you can be guaranteed of is that some girl in a headscarf on her way to school today is going to be bullied on the train.
Now, that's Tanya Plibersek there. Now, we know that there's not the support or the numbers in the Senate to have a debate about this motion that or this bill that Senator Hanson wanted to talk about. But she knows that getting a move like this, wearing the burqa, will get attention. And it's interesting that it's happening just as One Nation is getting pretty good polling results showing that there is quite a bit of growing support for the idea of voting for One Nation in the polls. A stunt like this definitely keeps her in the headlines. But we also had Senator George Brandis on the program a little earlier. His line fell out, so we didn't get all of his comments, but he made it pretty clear that he thought that the same thing will happen as what happened after the first time she put on a burqa in Parliament back in 2017. At that point, her numbers dropped, and this is what George Brandis thought would happen this time.
And I expect that that will happen again, because it reminds people both that the One Nation Party has absolutely nothing to offer the Australian people, but also that the kind of politics they practice are ugly and divisive politics.
George Brandis there, who led the condemnation of her first time around to when this happened in 2017.
And you were just listening to political correspondent Melissa Clark giving us an update on those comments from Tanya Plibersek and George Brandis. And if you want to hear that full interview with Tanya Plibersek, you can find it on the ABC Listen app. Just search for Radio National Breakfast and you'll see it in the stream. Well, something a little outside the day's headlines, but still a serious story nonetheless. Our next guest argues that mass shooters, terrorists and violent extremists are overwhelmingly misogynists, homophobes, or transphobes, even if they are motivated by other factors. That is essentially the thesis of the new book from Cynthia Miller Idris. She's an American professor of sociology, and at the American University in DC, she is the founding director of the Polarization and Extremism Research and Innovation Lab. She's in Australia to promote the book Man Up: The New Misogyny and the Rise of Violent Extremism. She's been meeting with local community and government leaders. She came on and explained to Sally the thinking behind her argument.
It's so glaringly obvious once you start to see it that you can't unsee it, but it's also so invisible so much of the time. But when you start to look at it, in the US alone, for example, 60% of all mass shooters have a documented history of domestic and intimate partner violence. And that is only the documented cases where we know there's tremendous underreporting. And it also doesn't include things like stalking or harassment or online misogyny or abuses, homophobic attacks, or even things like sexual assault or rape. So when you start to look at every case, I couldn't find one in the US, and I'm sure there are, but I stopped looking eventually. It's every single case has some sort of history of gendered motivations, misogynistic violence against women or the LGBTQ community. And so It's a major predictor. It's also a red flag, and it's a sign that there are ways we could prevent some of these violent extremist mobilizations earlier if we knew other types of violence to look for.
What do you think the media and politicians often get wrong about misogyny, violence, and internet trolls?
I think, first of all, they think of it as a personal issue. So even the way that we define misogyny typically is hatred of women. I use a different definition, which is the philosopher Kate Mann defines it as the law enforcement function of the patriarchy. It's more of a kind of gender policing, which means that women can do it as well as men. It also means that boys and young men are often affected by this as well, with the kind of bullying and sanctioning that comes when they don't measure up to their expected performance of gendered norms. And so I think we overlook it. I think we also often obscure it. So when we had the assassination of local politicians, state politicians in Minnesota, for example, because they were abortion advocates or LGBTQ allies, the media really only covered it. I never saw a single mention of that as a gendered attack. We just covered it as progressive politicians being attacked. And so I think there's a lot of ways that we are uncomfortable talking about gendered motivations, are uncomfortable talking about gendered norms, even when they're right there staring us in the face.
But it's not only, of course, been what would be labelled as progressive politicians who've been targeted. Right. There were two attempts at President Donald Trump prior to his re-election. We also saw Charlie Kirk being murdered and assassinated as well. Are there dangers in trying to have a one-size-fits-all approach here when sometimes the targets and the motivations, do they vary?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of the things that's helpful about looking at gender and misogyny is I'm not arguing that these are the primary motivations in every case, but that they are also often foundational components that link these precursors in mobilizations. And so we see this
but
in Islamists.
Is correlation and causation the same thing?
Yeah, they're not the same thing. And it's also not saying that the targets are often totally different than women or LGBTQ folks, but the perpetrators have a history of these types of beliefs and actions targeting women or gendered motivations. And so the argument there is that if we, for the prevention side, which I work on, if you can pay attention to some of those earlier warning signs, we might be able to intervene before someone mobilizes to much more violent action targeting racial and ethnic minorities or religious minorities, for example.
Is there any evidence-based early intervention programs that have been successful in the United States to de-radicalize those who might be on this path?
Yeah, the evidence on de-radicalization and disengagement is incredibly thin. There are successful programs that do it, but it's very one-on-one. Therapeutic intervention often takes years and can't be done unless the person is willing to participate and be de-radicalized. It's not unlike addiction treatment or something like that. What is effective, where there is a lot more evidence of scalability, is in the prevention at the primary level, preventing people from being persuaded by propaganda or conspiracy theories. So I run a research lab called Peril that has a lot of evidence about equipping parents, caregivers, teachers, mental health counselors, but also how to help young people themselves and older adults recognize manipulative tactics that might open up pathways. And so that's a much better bang for your buck, if you will, in terms of investing in scalability.
Cynthia Miller-Idris there, the American professor of sociology and author of Man Up, The New Misogyny and the Rise of Violent Extremism. We're going to end in Hollywood today with an interview featuring beloved actor Russell Crowe, and we're going to turn back the pages of history to the aftermath of the Second World War. 80 years ago, the Nuremberg trials broke new ground in international law with the idea of individual criminal responsibility, holding Nazi generals accountable for the atrocities committed during World War II. Now, those events have been dramatised in a new movie, Nuremberg. It depicts Nazi leader Hermann Göring in the cells awaiting trial, as played by the Oscar-winning actor Russell Crowe. He joined Sally this morning. This is what she asked him first.
The evil of Hermann Göring is well and extensively documented. As an actor, how did you go about also perhaps looking for humanity in someone who carried out such horrendous acts?
You know, one of the goals that I set myself was just to find out information that wasn't commonly known and understood, to go a little bit deeper than the other pieces that might have been put forward about Goering. So going into his childhood and his school life and his hobbies. You know, when you find out that Hermann Goering in his late teens was a mountain climber, so you're dealing with the sort of man that will stand at the base of the Austrian Alps and make a decision to go all the way to the top. And there were traverses in the Alps that he was the first man to do. So this is an unusual aspect to his personality. And through his history of being a failure as a student at school to then being sent as a punishment to a military school and becoming top of the class because it was now something he was interested in. To him becoming a fighter ace in the First World War, 22 air-to-air kills. So, you know, he was a serious, serious war hero in many German eyes, Hermann. And then taking that public position, I mean, he was on cigarette carts. He bought a packet of cigarettes in Berlin in the 20s, and you're likely to find a caricature or drawing of Hermann inside the packet of cigarettes. So for him to take that public position that he had and then become ambitious, and I believe from, you know, a patriotic point of view, he was looking at the devastation that the First World War and particularly the Treaty of Versailles had created in his country, and he wanted to do something about it. The thing is, you know, his ambition led him to connect himself to people who would, yes, advance his ambitions quicker, but to certain moral costs. So I just found the whole character very interesting and his family life and all that. Putting him in this situation where he is, you know, the greatest thing is, sometimes this doesn't happen when you're playing a character, you can't find things, but for this particular character, the well is so deep. There's so much stuff written about him, so many records. I even got my hands on the German equivalent of Hansard so I could read how he operated as the Reich Marshal in German Parliament. It was you know, fascinating from a research point of view. But trying to find that point where, obviously, you know, this patriotic man who wanted to serve his country allowed himself to be drawn into the situation that he did. That was the fascinating journey.
Russell, from all the accounts that we have and the transcripts, do you get any sense that any tiny particle of the horror of what was carried out ever penetrated the thinking of Hermann Goering?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Look, you have to understand, he grew up surrounded by Jewish people. His godfather was Jewish. You know, at one point in time, it is documented that he said that, you know, the anti-Semitism connection he saw as a convenience because it would bring a certain amount of people who, you know, needed something else to focus their anger on. But, you know, he was a supreme egotist. That is the other side of being a mountain climber.
Why? Why do you need to climb it?
Why? And, you know, the self-belief that you have to have in order to do that, you know, because at a certain point, every step is life and death. So, yeah, I do think those things landed on him. And I think you can see through his movements that around about 1942, he knew he'd lost the ear of Adolf. He wasn't the most trusted voice in the room anymore. So he sort of distanced himself and tried to, you know, create a narrative and control a narrative whereby at a certain point, the German people would look at these crazy men that were in positions of power and go, somebody mature needs to stop this. Hermann, can you help us? And he thought that was what the narrative was going to be. And at the end of the war, like you were talking about, there was no international crime war court. There was no, it didn't. This was created. And I think from a very, from a strong moral perspective, from a global community perspective, you know, we've had two world wars. How do we ensure this doesn't happen again? Make sure that the men in positions of power know that they will be held responsible for their actions. So from that perspective, it was a very strong idea.
And you were just listening to the Oscar award-winning actor Russell Crowe. He joined Sally to discuss his new movie, Nuremberg, depicting the Nazi leader Hermann Goering. Well, thank you very much for listening to The Breakfast Wrap today, our dip into Hollywood. Every interview was presented by Sally Sara, produced by the Radio National Breakfast team, and The Breakfast Wrap was today produced by Josie Scott. I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon. We'll be back in your ears, same time, same place, tomorrow.